Well, we are continuing our study in 1 Kings. We are in chapter 17. We kind of hurriedly went through several kingships. Several kingships in the last chapter of chapter 16. And we left off talking about kind of the early years of one infamous king at the end of chapter 16. Do you remember who that was? The infamous king of the northern tribe, who Ahab, not the Arab, Ahab, the king of Israel, and what is the brief commentary we get there at the end of chapter 16? The brief commentary: good guy, bad guy, bad guy, not just bad, but like really bad. So we have chapter 16 ends with this, like, one of the worst kings northern Israel has ever had, and really sort of like a Bonnie and Clyde kind of duo of evilness with Jezebel, right? Anybody naming their daughters Jezebel? Yeah. So Jezebel, and chapter 17, when we begin, who do you have mentioned at the very beginning of chapter 17? Elijah. Elijah's mentioned. Elijah's sort of the embodiment of all things prophet. We even get to see Elijah in the New Testament. Where do we see Elijah in the New Testament? Matthew chapter 17, if you want to. The Mount of Transfiguration, right? We don't know exactly how they know it's Moses and Elijah. Hello, my name is Elijah. You know, I don't know how they knew, but they knew. So Elijah was the sort of the embodiment of all things prophet. One of the more powerful prophets. And we'll see that as we go through. So you have one of the worst kings comes up to bat, and God calls up one of the most powerful prophets. So enter stage right, Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the elders of, or the Sellers of Gilead, which was a board game they used to play back then. The Sellers of Gilead said, "The Lord, and as the Lord, the God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, surely there will be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word," he says to Ahab, and turns around and leaves. So here is this. Ahab comes in, makes a statement, basically saying what? What is he saying by making that statement? It's not going to rain. It's going to get real dry, right? But how does he enter? As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives. None of these fake gods you're serving. As the Lord God of Israel lives, there will be no dew. There will be no rain as by my word. Okay? So, as it gets drier and drier and drier, do you think they're trying to figure out where he is? Do you think, hey, let's torture this guy and make him make it rain again, right? Make him do his dance. Whatever he's going to do to make it rain again. So God says to him in verse 2, "The Lord God came to him saying, 'Go away from here and turn eastward and hide yourself in the brook of Cherith, which is east of Jordan.'" So he's in Samaria over in, you know, kind of over in that area. And then he travels over. I think I actually have a picture of this. I think so. A picture. There it is. So he's in Samaria, right? And he's travels over to the brook, which is 30 miles-ish over towards this area where he hides for a while. And what happens while he's there? So normal things, just kind of hanging out, fishing in the creek. What happens while he's there? The ravens came, right? They feed him, they take care of him, which is different. But God's providing for him. Until what time? What happens that makes him move? It dries up. There's no more water, so he has to leave. And so when he leaves, verse 8, "The word of the Lord came to him and says, 'Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and stay there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you.'" So he leaves. I think I got another picture. I do. Here's another picture. He travels again, doesn't go into Israel, which was wise, stays on the outside of that, and goes up to Zarephath. Now, what do we know about Zarephath? Not much. But you know what? It's not Israelite. he went to the other team. He went over to the Phoenicians and stayed with them for a while. Because remember, in Israel, they're looking for who? Who's public enemy number one? Elijah, right? Because he's the dude that said it's not going to rain. So he's staying out of there. So he goes up, and God says what about this widow? What does he say about this widow? She's going to take care of him. I have commanded this widow. But wait a second. She's not an Israelite. Did God communicate to people who were not Israelites? Yes, he did. He did very much communicate. We know several prophets who were sent to people who were not Israelites, right? The most famous of which is Jonah, right? He was a little bit hesitant, but he went. So Jonah went. So there was communication with people who were not Israelites. And so this woman, God asked her to prepare or take care of. And so he rose and goes over there. And he meets this woman, widow, who's gathering sticks, and he says, "Can you bring me some water?" And she basically says that she will to do that. And as she was going to get it, he called to her and said, "Oh, by the way, can you bring me some bread too? I'm a little bit famished, right?" And so, how does she respond in verse 12? How does she respond to the request for bread? I don't have a lot, right? I don't have a lot. I've got enough. I'm gathering sticks. We're going to have our Last Supper, and we're going to die. That's kind of on our list of things to do this weekend. Okay, so that's what they're doing that weekend. Okay, so they don't have a lot of sustenance. This widow, and what is Elijah's response? Verse 13. Don't fear. God's going to take care of you. Right. What's interesting? She says to him, "As the Lord your God lives, I have no bread." So she automatically recognizes that he ain't from around here, okay? That he's not one of them. And so Elijah says, "Do not fear. Go do as you have said. Make me a little bread cake from it first and bring it out to me, and afterward you may make one for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bowl of flour shall not be exhausted, nor shall the jar of oil be empty until the day the Lord sends rain on the face of the earth." And so he went and did according to Elijah, and she and her household ate for many days, and the bowl of flour was not exhausted. And so they were able to be provided for during that time. If you want to write out here Luke chapter 4, verses 25 and 26, Jesus specifically mentions this woman. Luke chapter 4, 25 and 26 mentions the fact that God took care of her through Elijah. God blessed her because of Elijah. Probably happens in the lives of people around us, maybe, right? If we're living a life we're supposed to be living, can we be a blessing to people we're around? We certainly can and should be. And so Elijah was in this case. Now, it came about that while Elijah was with this woman, that her son became sick, so severe that he died. And in verse 18, so she said to Elijah, "What do I have to do with you, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my iniquity to remembrance and to put my son to death." She's grieving, right? And you search for why, you search for blame. You're the only thing that's changed, Elijah. You brought this upon me. You brought the remembrance of my sins and the death of my son. And what does Elijah do? Give me your son. That's how he responds. Give me your boy. Come here. Give him to me. And takes him up and prays to God. Now, recognize here, he says, "O Lord my God, you have also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die." It was a question, not an accusation. And so he asked for her son to be given back. "O Lord my God, I pray you let this child's life return to him." Verse 22, the Lord heard his voice after he laid upon, kind of a ceremonial bringing back life to the boy. And the life returned to the child. Elijah took the child back down and said, "See, here your son is alive." That was his two-phrase counseling session. give me your son. Here he is alive. You know, so he brings him back. What is her response? How does she respond to that? Now I know. Now I know. Exactly. Now I know that you are the man of God, that the word of the Lord is in your mouth. And so it's not necessarily that she didn't believe before, but for certain, there is no doubt in her mind. Here is a mother who knew her child was dead, and was brought back to her. So this is a very, very good thing as far as, again, Elijah being a blessing to her in that time. Chapter 18 opens about, you know, giving us sort of a timestamp. Now, it happened many days after this that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year. If you want to write out here Luke chapter 4, verse 25, and James 5, 17, they kind of both mention that this drought was about 3.5 years. They both mention that. And so it comes about that Elijah, in the third year, the Lord came to him and said, "Go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, who was over his household, and it gives us sort of some information about Obadiah. What does it say about Obadiah and who he is in verses 3 and 4? He feared the Lord. What evidence do we have of that? He hid the prophets of God, right? He hid at least over 100 of them and was taking care of them, feeding them. And that's what he did, even though it was sort of taboo to do that at the time. And we'll read more about that later. Because of the persecution of the Jews on the Jews. So Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land and all the springs of water to all the valleys, and perhaps we'll find grass and keep the horses and mules alive." So it is so bad that the king himself is going to look for grass. Okay? It's gotten so bad that there's no longer really any social barriers. Everybody's just trying to what? Survive. Okay? And so the king himself and the keeper of his house are sent out in different directions to find grass. Somewhere maybe there's grass so we can feed the animals and not to kill them. And while he's out, while Obadiah is out on the way, he sees Elijah. He meets up with Elijah. And when he recognizes that it's Elijah, he falls on his face and says, "Elijah, my master." So he recognizes who Elijah is. He is reverent towards a man of God like Elijah. And he says, "Elijah said, it's me. Go tell basically Ahab that Elijah is here." And his response is interesting. He says, "What sin have I committed that you are giving your servant into the hand of Ahab to put me to death?" Did you read a death sentence in what Elijah asks of him? I didn't see a death sentence in there. What is he saying? He said, "Hey, just go tell him I'm here." But what does Obadiah begin to process in all of this? What does he begin to say? He's saying, "We have been looking for you, man, all over the place. So much so that we've been going to other countries and making them swear that they've looked for you and that you're not there. So if I go over there and tell Ahab, hey, he's like in our backyard, and then Ahab comes out here and you're not here, you leave and go somewhere else, ha ha ha, funny, I'm going to die. He's going to kill me because I told him you were here and you're not here." And so Obadiah is more than just a little bit concerned about his own life. He says, you know, "I've done good things." He gives him his little, I've been helping these prophets, so I'm not, you don't need to really kill me, if that's what he's saying. I hid them from Jezebel. But Elijah tells him, he promises him, he says in verse 15, "As the Lord's host lives before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." So Obadiah is relieved and goes and tells him, and Ahab comes and they have a little chat. Now, I want to point out that this Obadiah is not the Obadiah that has a book named after him, not that Obadiah. Names get recycled. How many Joshes do you know? Okay, so names get recycled, all right? This is not the same Obadiah. That Obadiah lived much later in another time period in a galaxy far, far away. So not the same Obadiah. But when Ahab comes, what does he say to Elijah? Oh, hey, man, what's up? Is that what he says? You troubler of Israel. You're the one that's been causing all the problems. And what does Elijah say? No, you're the trouble of Israel. That's sort of the I'm the rubber, you're the glue kind of response, right? So no, you're the trouble of Israel. I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and you have followed after the Baals. And now then, send and gather me all Israel at Mount Carmel, not the candy, Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of the Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table, which is a big table apparently. So basically she's taking care of these prophets from the king's treasury, taking care of these guys, these guys who are worshipers or prophets of these false gods. And he throws down the gauntlet and says, we're going to do this out at Mount Carmel. Carmel. Now, if you look on this map right here, is this the one? Yes. So this little thing, like Israel's coastline is pretty bland until you get right here. This is a mountain range, and Carmel's right here. And a little valley, this is Jezreel Valley, and there's like a little brook we'll be talking about right at the base of that valley. Let me go back to our actual outline. There you go. So that's where they're going to go to have this showdown, this epic showdown, battle royale, right? Between, you've read this story before, haven't you? Okay, so you know what's about to happen. It gets pretty epic in relationship to what's this showdown. And so they go, and Ahab sent message along with of Israel, and they go out to Mount Carmel, and because there's nothing else to do really, right? And so Elijah came near and all the people. And this is a rather famous passage of Scripture in verse 21. How long will you hesitate between two opinions? Literally it says, how long will you limp along on two decisions? You're limping along between two things. You're not firm on either one of them. But we translate it here, how long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people did not answer him a word. Now, if you write out there, Joshua 24:15, very similar kind of question is asked of Israel at that time. There was a definite ring of answer at that moment, right? They responded that they'll serve the Lord. In this case, they were silent. And that's not a good response when somebody asks you about how you're going to serve God. They did not answer. And so what does he begin to say? He says, I'm alone, I'm left, a prophet of the Lord. The Baal's prophets are 450 men. Truth is not determined by numbers, is it? Well, everybody's doing it. Truth is not determined by numbers. And so he stands. Is he really the only one left? No, there's some guys hiding in caves somewhere. We know those guys are somewhere. We know Obadiah is kind of off, and he follows God. He's not the only one, but he's putting himself out there as the only one. And they what do they do in preparation for this? What's the ramification or the parameters of this contest? Do you remember? Yes, we've got two oxen, and we're going to offer them to God. And the guys, Team Baal, gets to go first, and they prepare their altar. They put the firewood on it, and they put the ox on it, and then they begin to dance around it and do whatever they do to call upon their God to light the fire, right? Light the fire and make it burn is what they're wanting their God to do. Does it happen right away? They start in the morning. The text tells us they start in the morning, and they go until mid-afternoon, essentially, until around 3 or 4 o'clock, they're doing this. Now, after, in their despair, they begin to do what? They begin to cut themselves and bleed all over the place, trying to get this God to answer. And then Elijah, being the great team player he is. He begins to coax them along or poke them just a bit in verse 26. He says, they took the oxen which was given them, and they prepared it and called it the name of Baal from morning until noonday. And there was no answer. Down in verse 27, it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied or gone aside or is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be wakened. This phrase here, gone aside, does anybody have a different translation? Yes, he may be in the bathroom, is actually what he's saying in there. So he's poking just a bit at them. And they're over there cutting themselves, and he's making fun of them in their response. And so obviously nothing happens. Obviously this nothing happens at all. And what's interesting down here in verse 29, there was no voice, no one answered, and no one paid attention. Because you know what? There was nobody there. They weren't saying anything to anybody. There was nobody there. There was nobody listening, which is telling, because what is the opposite of our God? He listens, he cares, and he's paying attention. That's the opposite. That's who we have in our God. But then Elijah begins to make this, come near to me. And so all the people kind of shuffle over. So they're watching over here on team Baal. And then Elijah calls them over, and they kind of shuffle over here to watch what Elijah's about to do. Not only does he prepare this offering, but he also does what with the offering? Trench around it, and then just douses the thing with water. Not once, not twice. Thrice they douse this thing with water, and it is sort of opposite of what you would normally do if you're going to light. Anybody tried to light a fire with something that's wet? Doesn't work. It doesn't work. And so now the altar is prepared. What does he do? What does he do here when he prepares the altar? In verse 31, what does he do? He took how many stones? 12 stones. God is a God of a unified Israel. That was his commentary, not on the fact that they have torn down the altar. He had to rebuild it. But he took 12 stones because we need to be unified. We need to be unified under God. And so he takes the 12 stones and he makes this altar. This whole process is a commentary on what they should be doing. And so they begin to do this. And so he says, Israel shall be your name. So he's talking about the tribes there. And so with the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around it. And we talked about all the things and the pitchers of water, and it's done. And then he prays in verse 36. At the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, Lord, are God, that you have turned their heart back again. What is interesting is that God is still trying to win them back. They've killed his prophets. They've torn down the altars. They've persecuted what it means to be a true Israelite, and he still is trying to convince them to come back. That they may be convinced, that they may come back and turn their hearts again is what's going on. Is there a long delay between the prayer and this fiery event? We don't get the idea, the impression, no, that there is a delay. This just, you know, like NORAD... laser beam comes down out of the sky and just consumes the altar and everything. Now, I don't know if you guys know at what temperature rocks burn, but apparently the internet does. So rocks burn, depending on what kind of rock it is, between 24,000 and 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is very hot. So it not only consumed the sticks and the offering, but it consumed the rocks themselves and consumed all the water, and it was just dried up cremation mess right there where that altar used to be when God was done with it. Was there any doubt that God answered the prayer? There was no doubt. And what happened after that took place? The people began to pay attention, right? Something happened here that didn't happen with the other guys. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." Then Elijah uses that moment to seize the prophets. They take them down off the mountain, down to this dried creek bed at this point, I guess, and begin to just slaughter these guys, which is what they were supposed to do if you worshiped false gods. You're supposed to stone them. If you have that many guys, you're not going to have enough time to stone them. So they just cut them with a sword and put them to death. And then we get this Elijah is basically saying that there's going to be water coming. And so they're told in verse 41, Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up and eat and drink, for there's sound of the roar of a mighty shower." And so Ahab went up to eat and drink, but Elijah went up to the top of Carmel. And he crouched down on the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, "Go up now and look toward the sea." So he went up and looked and said, "There's nothing." And then he said, "Go back." Seven times they went through this process. Go up and look towards the sea. They're on top of this mountain, right there by the ocean. Remember? We saw that on the map. So he's just going over and looking towards the ocean. "Do you see anything?" Nothing yet. "Now do you see anything?" "Nope, nothing yet." Seven times. And then he said, "Hey, there's this little cloud out there. This is really small. It's coming." And Elijah tells his servant, go tell Ahab to get in his chariot and get on the road, because there's about to be a lot of water and the creek is going to rise and he ain't going to get across it unless he gets going now. Basically, it's the paraphrased version of that. You can read it if you want to. So if he didn't go, he was going to have to be stuck. In verse 45, he says, In a little while the sky grew black and the clouds wind and there was a heavy shower, and Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. Then the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins and outran Ahab to Jezreel. So, I don't know if you ever raced anybody before or if you've tried to race a horse. You're not going to win. You're not going to win. Now, the chariot is going to have to go on the road, and Elijah could cut cross country, right? Could just do the whole as a crow flies kind of thing. But still, he would still have to be scooting to beat him to that city, right? So it is obvious that the power of the Lord is upon him when he does this. And he girds up his, we've talked about, what the girding up, the little skirt thing they're wearing, I guess, and moves and goes out there. My question is if his servant has to do that too. Doesn't say. His servant's like, "Oh man, now I gotta run after this guy." Anyway, so chapter 19. So we have a literally a mountaintop experience in chapter 18. Chapter 19, we kind of have a valley in relationship to Elijah. Now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed the prophets with a sword. Now, what's so interesting is that there is zero word that Ahab said, "Stop, don't do that, don't kill the prophets." There's zero word. Ahab said zilch about that. We kind of get the idea that Ahab is sort of a follow-along kind of guy. He's not the guy that's going to just stand up and take charge. We kind of get the idea that it's not Ahab that wears the pants in the relationship in this, right? So so he goes and he goes and tells his wife. I don't know if he's whining when he's telling her what's going on, but he's telling her what happened. Is she happy about it? No, she's not happy about it. What does she say? I got more of those. What does she say whenever she finds out? Yeah, hey, I'm going to do the same thing to him. So may the gods do to me and more, even more, if I don't make your life as one of the life of one of them by tomorrow. And verse 3, what is his response when he hears about that? He was afraid. Now, he was not afraid of, again, he was not afraid of Ahab, but he was afraid of Jezebel. Have you ever seen a woman that's just like really mad? Maybe there's reason to be afraid. I'm not going to tell you who, but somebody at this church threatened to break my arm one time. And I believed her. But so in this situation, he was afraid. Now, he just, these were guys who were cutting themselves. They were so convicted about what they believed in. They were cutting themselves. And he's poking fun at him. And then he's over here, and now this queen says, I'm going to kill you. And he's like afraid all of a sudden. Does that seem like, it doesn't make sense to us. There has to be something in who Jezebel is that makes him believe that it's a credible threat. Does that make sense? So the threats that from Ahab, but it was a credible threat when Jezebel said that this was going to happen. And so what does he do? He arose and ran for his life, or his own soul is what literally translated, and came to Beersheba. Now, where is Beersheba? We talked about from Dan to Beersheba. So he went as far away from her that he could possibly be and still be in God's kingdom. Right? He went to Beersheba, which was 95 miles away to the south. And then he left his servant there, and his servant's probably, thank you, because I don't want to be going where you're going. He left his servant there, and where did he go from there? He went a day's journey into the wilderness, right? And came and sat down under a juniper tree and requested for himself that he might die. What happened, man? What happened? Pull yourself together. It's kind of what you want to say to him. It could be. There could be some psychological things going on here. But has it ever happened to us? Have you ever been like in a situation where I'm going to do the right thing, I'm going to make the right choices, I'm taking charge of my life, I'm doing this, and then the next day, the first temptation out of the box, and you fall to pieces? Can you blame him? Are we not human? And so here is Elijah in this situation. Kill me now. He says, is it enough? Now, O Lord, take my life, for I'm not better than my father's. He lay down and slept under a juniper tree. An angel comes and gives him some food and says, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was bread, and he ate it, and he lay back down. And an angel came in verse 7. And the angel came and said a second time and touched him, saying, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you. I put out here Luke chapter 22, verse 43. When Jesus was in the garden, who came to him and took care of him? Angels. Did they do this kind of thing for him? Maybe. We don't know. We don't know what they did for Jesus in the garden. We don't know. But they took care of Elijah here because of what he was about to go through. It's possible they did something similar to Jesus for Jesus because of what he was about to go through. And so he says, because the journey is too great. So he arose, ate and drank, and went in the strength of that food for 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. Moses also went 40 days and 40 nights, Deuteronomy 9:9. Jesus went 40 days and 40 nights, Matthew 4:2. And they're the ones that were on the mountain. Is that like a 40 days and 40 night club? I don't know that necessarily, but here are people who are serious about their conviction and serious, obviously, about their service to God, and it's those who are the ones that get to see Jesus and saying, hey, here's what we were talking about the whole time. Here's what we were talking about as it's being unfolded before the apostles and the time of Jesus. Now, he goes to Horeb, and it's Moses who says to the Israelites all the time, remember Horeb, don't forget Horeb. What happened at Horeb? You might remember it as Sinai, the Ten Commandments. Do not forget Horeb. Where is he running to? He's running to God. He's running to God. I'm at the bottom, and I'm running to God. I know where God is. I know where Moses saw God, and I'm going to go there. And he runs there to see God. Does he see God? What happens when he goes there? Do you remember? He came there, verse 9, in the cave and lodged there. And behold, the Lord, word of the Lord came to him and said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? This isn't where I sent you. This isn't where I sent you. And he gives him a rehearsed statement, verse 10. I have been very zealous, by the way. I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of the hosts, the sons of Israel. I've forsaken your, the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, tore down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left. Then they seek my life to take it away. He says this twice, the same thing, whenever God asks him again. So here he says, what are you doing here? And so verse 11, God says, so go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great strong wind was rending the mountains. This would be awesome to see, by the way. If you want to flash back, this would be awesome to see. This great wind was rending the mountains in pieces and the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after a fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? And what does he respond? The same rote response, what he was remembering, what he was thinking about those 40 days when he was on his way to Horeb, what he was thinking when he was wanting to die, this rehearsed statement to God. I'm very zealous. Nobody loves me or you, by the way, and they want to kill us. What is he asking him? This is not what I've asked you to do. What are you doing here? I don't know if you've ever been in a low spot in your life and never came to a realization, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? How did I get here? What's interesting is that he didn't leave Elijah just on his own devices. After he asked that question and Elijah has this response, what does God do? What does he do? He gives him work. He gives him focus and purpose again. And he says, the Lord said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram, and Jehu the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. Now, what's interesting about these people, it's these people that bring about the demise of the ones who have killed your prophets and who hunt me right now. So he sends them back to take care of business and to put people in place. They're going to take care of God's people. But how is that connected with a still small voice? When we think of God, and when you saw God on the mountain, you saw this huge powerful display of who God was, right? And when you see the wind rending the mountains and tearing them apart, and you see the earthquake, and you see the fire, you'd expect that's where God's going to be, right? But could God be in a still, small wind? Could God make changes with small things? Yes. God's message to Elijah was, I'm in the small things. I'm in the details about life. Get these people activated, basically. Get them going, and they're going to take care of what problem you have right now. Do the work I've given you to do, and things will work out. I'm in the details. That's the message that Elijah needed. Do we need that message? I'm in the details. I'm in the small things. We look for the big pictures. We ask God for these big, huge displays. If you'd only do this, Peter said, and the disciples said, just show us the Father, and that's good enough. Just show us the Father, and that's good enough. His response was, I'm standing right in front of you. Standing right in front of you. Same thing for us. We need to know that God is in the details, and God has given us a work to do. And you know what? When we're working and we're moving forward, do we forget about sometimes the distractions that are around us? How many of you go to work, look forward to going to work because you can focus and forget about just the worries and cares? Anybody? It's the same thing. When we get busy about our Father's business, we can get focused and forget about the worries and cares. And so he did that for Elijah, and Elijah goes back and he says, yet I leave 7,000 in Israel. You're not by yourself. Elijah created this Lone Ranger complex, didn't he? He created that. That was his own complex. They said, no. God's like, no. Reality check. That is not what is happening. And sometimes we create our own demons by our own misconceptions of what's of reality. And so he departed and he goes and he finds Elisha. He finds Elisha. And what's interesting is that Elijah never anointed these guys. These other guys that were supposed to be anointed, it was Elisha finished that work. So he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, and while he was plowing with 12 pairs of oxen before him, and with the 12th, and then Elijah passed over to him and threw his mantle on him. His mantle is like his like camel hair shirt kind of thing that he's wearing. He kind of threw it on him, which was probably kind of sweaty and nasty, but he threw it on him. And it was sort of a cultural thing. Obviously, he knew what was going on. He says, please, he threw his mantle on him, and he left the oxen and ran after Elijah because he knew what Elijah was doing. And he said, please let me kiss my father and mother, and then I will follow you. And he said, go back again, and what have I done for you? You can go ahead and do that, basically, is what he's telling him here. If you want to write out here Luke chapter 9, verses 59 and 61, there was one person, a would-be disciple of Jesus, who said, let me bury my father and my mother. And Jesus said what? Let the dead bury the dead. But in this case, his parents aren't dead. He's just wanting to say goodbye, right? So let me say goodbye, and I'm right behind you. So he does that and returned to following him. He took a pair of oxen and sacrificed them and boiled their flesh and implements of the oxen and gave it to the people. Basically, he was saying, I'm done. I'm burning what I could go back to. I'm burning what I could go back to, and I'm following Elijah, is what he's doing, is what that means. And so he follows Elijah and ministers to him. And we'll end with chapter 19. Any questions, comments? Yes, ma'am. We are under the impression that they're all gone.
Oh, I thought maybe they're witnesses.
I don't know. I don't know. We're under the impression that they're all dead. Did you all hear that question? There's a lot of prophets. We're under the impression that they're all disposed of. We don't know exactly details on that. Anyway, excellent. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.